Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Chris Vanderbilt, and I'm ready to unpack some seriously dense and fascinating financial material for you today.
And I'm Alex Astor. We are embarking on a deep dive into the most critical insights drawn from the sources you shared with us, specifically Barron's Magazine, for the week of October 20th, 2025.
That's right. Our mission today is a comprehensive, full-spectrum analysis. This particular issue is defined by fascinating extremes, really. Mm-hmm. You've got record-breaking tech valuations, the explosion of the AI infrastructure trade sitting right alongside, well, bubbling credit risks in the banking sector, and frankly, historic demand for safe haven assets like gold.
Yeah, it's quite the mix.
So we are cutting through the noise to give you the essential map for navigating this highly complex environment. We'll cover everything from nuclear energy kingpins to the quieter defense strategies you might need for your retirement portfolio.
And we'll explore that defining tension of the moment, this, you know, demand for perfection that's priced into the AI plays, while also examining the specific financial vulnerabilities that could potentially unwind that entire thesis.
Forcing investors back towards stability and defense.
Exactly. We're here to help you understand not just what is happening, but why it matters right now.
Okay, let's dig into this, starting with the biggest driver, I think, of investment dollars today.
Yeah.
The sheer colossal amount of power required to fuel artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
The cover story this week is all about Constellation Energy, ticker CEE, and why they are being crowned the electricity kingpin of this new era.
Well, the core argument for Constellation, it's rooted in a staggering reality. AI data centers have an insatiable demand for power. It's completely reshaping the energy landscape.
Insatiable, that's a strong word.
It is. The scale of this demand just dwarfs anything we've seen in past tech eras. I mean, the estimates detailed in the sources suggest power demand could rise tenfold by 2030. A truly massive figure.
Tenfold. Okay, let's put that in perspective for you, the listener. Fulfilling that demand rise, it would be the power equivalent of adding 45 entirely new nuclear reactors to the U.S. grid.
Wow.
In less than 5 years. That's an almost unimaginable construction challenge, isn't it?
It really is. Which is why CEG, with its existing assets, is suddenly so valuable.
Right.
Precisely. Constellation already produces most of its power through 21 nuclear reactors across the U.S. That accounts for roughly a quarter of America's total nuclear generation.
Okay.
And crucially, they also own significant wind and hydro assets.
Mm-hmm.
So this diverse power mix means their supply is both reliable and, importantly, carbon-free.
Which is exactly what the big tech giants are demanding, right? Well, Microsoft, Meta,
yeah.
They need to meet their ESG goals while powering these massive data centers.
Exactly. And CEO Joe Dominguez has masterfully positioned Constellation to capitalize on this scarcity. I mean, since its 2022 market debut, the stock has just skyrocketed up over 750%.
Incredible run. But the major strategic news detail this week is their aggressive expansion plan.
Yeah, that plan centers on the massive agreement to buy privately held Calpine. We're talking $26.6 billion in stock and cash.
That's huge.
And this isn't just a simple bolt-on acquisition. It fundamentally changes Constellation's profile and, you know, its market reach.
Okay, so how does the Calpine acquisition enhance their ability to serve this AI boom specifically? What does it bring to the table?
Well, first, it boosts their potential electricity output by some 80%. Huge increase.
80%.
But it also adds strategic flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Calpine brings 61 highly efficient natural gas plants, significant utility-scale battery storage capabilities, and sort of the jewel in the crown, the Geysers geothermal resource in Northern California.
Ah, the Geysers.
Right. The country's largest geothermal resource. So once this deal closes, Constellation becomes the dominant face of modern power generation, serving the power needs of over 40 million homes across the country.
But let's pause on the history here, because the sources highlight Dominguez's caution, and for good reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
The power producer industry has a notoriously rocky history. I mean, chasing massive demand waves led companies like Calpine itself and NRG into bankruptcy back in the early 2000s when those demand forecasts just didn't materialize.
Yeah, that's a crucial point.
So how is Constellation mitigating the risk of overbuilding this time? What's different?
Well, he seems acutely focused on learning from the mistakes of the past. Dominguez is not immediately embarking on massive new reactor construction.
Which is incredibly high risk long term.
Exactly. High risk, multi-decade endeavor costs notoriously hard control. Instead, the strategy is sort of twofold. utilize and optimize existing assets.
Okay, utilize and optimize. That brings us to the fascinating anecdote about using old plants, doesn't it?
Yes. The primary strategy involves upgrading existing equipment, basically using engineering upgrades to safely squeeze more capacity from current facilities.
Got it.
And the other, maybe more visible strategy, is reopening previously shut reactors. The Three Mile Island example is a perfect case study here.
Right, the non-accident reactor.
Exactly. Constellation is working to bring that site's non-accident-related reactor back online, aiming for 2027. But here is the critical business detail.
Okay.
They secured a 20-year deal with Microsoft to buy that power at a rate that analysts estimate is at least twice the going market price for electricity in that area.
Wait, hold on. Securing power for 2 decades at double the current market rate? That sounds, well, almost like a panic deal from Microsoft.
It certainly suggests urgency, doesn't it?
What does that revenue certainty mean for Constellation, though?
Well, it provides an almost impenetrable floor for revenue. It's risk mitigation for Constellation combined with massive, reliable earnings visibility for decades.
Makes sense.
And similarly, they secured a long-term agreement with Meta for power from a plant in Illinois, where CEG plans to execute exactly this uprating strategy to add capacity. They're essentially selling every available electron years in advance at premium prices to these anchor tenant customers.
So investors are clearly paying up for this unique position. DEG trades at, what, 32.9 times expected 2026 earnings. That's high, even for today's market.
It is high.
Why should you, the long-term investor, rationalize this premium? What's the real justification?
Well, the stronger case for Constellation isn't really based on next year's earnings multiple. It's based on the economics of replacement value. That's the fundamental economic moat they possess.
Okay, replacement value. Explain that.
Building these types of power plants today is just prohibitively expensive and incredibly time-consuming. So the combined assets of Constellation and Calpine, they're currently valued at roughly $2,500 per kilowatt. However, the estimated replacement cost, factoring in things like, say, $8,500 per kilowatt for new nuclear capacity and maybe $2,500 per kilowatt for new gas plants, that replacement cost is estimated to be more than $4,000 per kilowatt.
Wow. So that's a 60% discount to replacement cost embedded in the current valuation?
Pretty much, yeah.
Why is that the single most important factor?
Because it means that Constellation has this enormous structural advantage that rivals just cannot easily penetrate. Any competitor trying to enter the market today has to raise capital to build at a cost that is dramatically higher than CEG's existing asset base.
Right.
That difference provides an economic moat that essentially guarantees Constellation's pricing power for the foreseeable future. And this belief, it seems, cemented by the fact that Calpine's largest shareholder, Energy Capital Partners, they're taking the vast majority of their $26.6 billion compensation in Constellation stock.
Ah, interesting. Skin in the game.
Exactly. They are betting on this long-term replacement value story, not just the current quarter.
Okay, so moving from the power generation side to the actual physical building blocks of the AI infrastructure, Quanta Services, ticker PWR, they are the essential grid enabler, right? Modernizing the infrastructure needed to handle this massive new load.
Quanta is absolutely crucial here because the century-old U.S. electrical grid was simply never built for the intensity and the location-specific demands that data centers require.
Right.
So Quanta provides specialized industrial services to utilities and energy companies. They handle the essential maintenance of aging plants, the modernization, the replacement of transmission lines. They are really the key bottleneck solver for the AI trade.
And the sources highlight that Quanta's unique value isn't just in their equipment, which is significant, but it's in their people.
That's right. Their unique defensible advantage is scale, yes, but also unparalleled access to highly specialized personnel, what's known as craft labor.
Craft labor.
Yeah, this workforce includes certified line workers, specialized riggers, welders, engineers, people capable of safely working on high voltage transmission lines, often in remote or difficult locations. This skill set is scarce. It takes years to develop.
And that scarcity gives them pricing power.
Serious pricing power and minimal competition.
Yeah. And the financial results seem to reflect that scarcity value.
They do. Quanta operates with a massive, highly visible backlog of $36 billion. Mm. That metric translates directly into predictable, high-margin revenue growth.
Mm.
They've also worked hard to shed the cost overruns and execution issues that frankly, played them about a decade ago.
Yeah.
They seem like a much more disciplined, operationally focused company now.
So what are analysts expecting?
Analysts expect their earnings per share to climb over 17% this year and next, driven by this predictable pipeline of high-margin infrastructure work.
Okay, but 35 times 2026 earnings still feels steep, doesn't it? What's the rationale for that high multiple? And I guess, what's the worst-case scenario if Quanta somehow loses its labor advantage?
Look, the market seems to grant this premium because it's seen as an earned premium, right? Driven by that scarcity and consistent execution. The worst-case scenario. Maybe the tight labor market eases significantly and wage inflation eats into their margins more than expected.
Possible.
Possible. But given the multi-decade horizon for grid modernization, that labor moat looks pretty secure for now.
Yeah.
We also have to remember, their growth drivers extend far beyond AI.
Right. That's a good point.
Massive mandatory infrastructure modernization is happening, regardless of data center demand. Think about the extensive projects underway in California, for instance, burying power lines deep underground to mitigate catastrophic wildfire risks.
That's billions in revenue right there.
Exactly. That work alone guarantees billions in revenue, irrespective of AI.
And from a technical perspective, the charting looks positive, too.
Yeah, the sources mentioned the stock recently broke out above a key pivot point, around $425.04.
Yeah.
I completed a technical cup-based pattern on the charts. This technical backdrop, combined with the strong fundamentals, suggests potential further upside, maybe towards $500 by Q2 next year, provided the stock maintains support above, say, the $390 level.
So it's a high-quality growth play on a necessary structural trend.
Pretty much. The energy transition.
Okay, so we've established that the power trade is incredibly expensive, highly concentrated in the market. If you, the listener, think maybe the market has priced in too much perfection there, what is the ideal opposite trade?
The anti-AI trade.
Exactly. That brings us to part two, the anti-AI trade and how to play necessary defense in your portfolio.
So we shift our focus immediately to household staples, specifically Colgate-Palmolive ticker CL. Now, this stock has been really out of style, falling over 20% in the last 12 months.
Why the slump?
Largely due to an industry-wide slowdown in sales growth, plus concerns about inflation affecting consumer spending this year, just general pressure on staples.
But investors focused on stability, maybe they need to look past that short-term slump. Because Colgate is a genuine dividend king, an absolute global powerhouse, operates with significant defensive moats.
That is the crucial context, yes. They are the world's undisputed top toothpaste maker, 41% global market share.
41%. Wow.
And their Hill's pet food segment is a terrific, stable, high-margin business. It continues to provide reliable growth even when other segments might struggle.
And the resilience of pet food is huge, right? People cut back elsewhere before they cut back on pet spending.
Generally, yes. It adds a huge factor of stability to the entire enterprise.
And their geographical footprint provides a growth story that purely domestic companies just don't have access to.
Absolutely. Nearly half of Colgate's sales are generated from higher growth developing markets. Their position in Latin America is particularly strong. They command nearly 50% market share there. It's their largest, most important division. They're also the oral care market leader in India. So this international strength is fundamental to the bull case, which expects the company to stabilize and return to that critical 3-5% organic sales growth range in 2026.
Recovering from the 2% slowdown they're projecting for 2025?
Exactly. Recovering from that dip.
And what does this mean for income-focused investors? Why look at Colgate now?
Well, their appeal there is undeniable. They're one of the rare dividend kings, having raised their payout for 62 straight years.
Oh, 62 years. That's impressive consistency.
It is. And it offers a secure, modest dividend yield of about 2.7% right now. Furthermore, compared to its 10-year average price-to-earnings ratio of around 23 times, the stock looks reasonably priced today at 20 times projected 2026 earnings.
So below its historical average.
Yes. It's arguably the perfect, affordable antidote for a portfolio that might be overexposed to that high-flying tech volatility we were just talking about.
Okay, if we continue down this path of defensive investments, let's look at how one expert, Robert Moskow, thinks about surviving the headwinds in the packaged food industry. Another sector facing significant pressures, right? Inflation, tariffs, this Make America Healthy Again movement.
Yeah, Moskow's analysis offered some critical and maybe counterintuitive strategic advice. He argues pretty strongly that packaged food companies should not attempt to become healthy fresh food companies.
Really? Why not? Isn't that where the trend is?
Well, his point is that's a different supply chain, a different business model entirely. It's fundamentally not their core competency. They're set up for shelf-stable processed goods.
Okay, so if they shouldn't pursue freshness, where does success lie for them?
Success comes from leaning into what they do best, convenience and affordable indulgence. He cites Jamin Smucker's wildly successful Uncrustables line as a perfect example.
Ah, Uncrustables. Kids love those.
Right. That product's unique combination of taste, texture, convenience.
Right.
It provides sufficient value for consumers to keep paying a premium, even in an inflationary environment. It's about leveraging existing brand equity and distribution networks efficiently, not chasing a completely different model.
Makes sense. The analysis also delves into some specific corporate maneuverings, talking about scale, whether it's a benefit or a liability in this space.
Yeah, Moscow is critical of arguments suggesting the breakup of major conglomerates. He specifically argues against splitting PepsiCo into separate food and beverage companies.
Why keep them together?
He believes the true value lies in their combined scale and, crucially, the advertising synergies. Think about it. A joint marketing campaign linking Pepsi Soda with Frito-Lay chips.
Right. Cross promotion.
It allows them to achieve a massive advertising reach and pricing power that two separate entities could never match. Separating them would actually destroy that cross-category leverage.
He also critiques an acquisition in the beverage space, didn't he?
Yes, he was not pleased with Keurig. Dr. Pepper's recent and apparently poorly received acquisition of a coffee business.
What was the issue there?
Well, shareholders had apparently been hoping the company would reduce its overall exposure to the volatile coffee market. Instead, this deal actually tripled their exposure to global coffee.
Tripled it. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Which he viewed as deeply unattractive given the lack of clear strategic synergy between the new global coffee assets and their existing more regional beverage focus. Seemed like a misstep strategically.
Okay. This underlying need for defensive stability, it's really underscored by the return of measurable market volatility this week. We saw the S&P 500 fall, what, 2.7% on a single day?
Yeah, that ended a pretty calm streak of 33 trading days. Abruptly.
And this is more than just a fluctuation, isn't it? It's maybe a necessary wake-up call for investors who've grown perhaps dangerously complacent.
I think that's fair. The biggest issue today, arguably, is concentration risk. Over 25% of the S&P 500's market capitalization is concentrated in just four massive tech stocks.
Nvidia, Microsoft, Apple, Alphabet.
Those four. So if you are exclusively invested in a standard cap-weighted S&P 500 fund, you are overwhelmingly exposed to that highly concentrated premium-priced AI trade we just discussed. Very little diversification at the top.
So what's the Zen way, as the source puts it, to handle this volatility and concentration risk? How do you ensure you can truly sleep well at night? The sources provide three concrete diversification tactics.
Okay, the first tactic is to dramatically spread your equity risk beyond just the U.S. market. For the last year, the MSCI ACWI XUSA Index, that index explicitly excludes U.S. stocks. It's up about 26% year-to-date.
26%. That's way ahead of the S&P 500's 13% gain.
Dramatically outperforming. So professional advisors are now recommending allocating about 25% of your equity assets to non-U.S. stocks to capture this diversification benefit and potential outperformance.
Okay, international diversification. What's the second tactic? This one addresses the concentration problem within the U.S. index itself.
Right, without forcing you to abandon domestic stocks entirely. That is the use of equal-weighted index funds.
Like the Invesco S&P 500 equal-weight ETF.
Exactly. The key difference is this fund doesn't weight companies by size. It treats all 500 companies equally. So as a result, no single stock represents more than, say, 0.2% of its assets.
They're much more spread out.
Dramatically less concentrated. A safer approach, arguably, which is vital when a quarter of the cap-weighted index is dictated by just four companies.
Okay. And the third piece of advice goes completely old school, using a time-tested asset for protection. Gold.
Yeah, gold is up 57% this year. It is truly the new golden child, hitting record highs consistently. The advice here isn't necessarily to chase that massive performance now.
Right.
But to maintain a fixed strategic allocation of around 5% to physical gold or a gold derivative like the SPDR Gold Shares ETF, ticker GLD. Think of it as fundamental fire insurance for your portfolio against geopolitical chaos or financial systemic collapse.
5% for fire insurance makes sense. This Zen approach also includes a highly specific goals-based bond strategy tailored for retirees and those needing cash flow protection.
Yes, and this is designed specifically to remove market timing anxiety. The recommendation is, first, determine the annual amount you need for living expenses in retirement.
Right.
Then set aside 10 years worth of that cash cushion.
10 years? That's a lot.
It is. But the idea is that entire amount should be insulated in short-term and intermediate-term high-quality bonds using funds like the Schwab Short-Term U.S. Treasury ETF, SCHO, or perhaps the Dimensional Core Fixed Income ETF, DCOR.
And the purpose of that 10-year cushion?
It's designed purely to provide essential peace of mind. It allows you to ride out any major equity market decline without being forced to sell your stocks at a loss just to cover living expenses.
Yeah.
It buys you time.
Okay, we've talked about the high-flying bull market and how to defend against it. But now we really must turn to the potential Achilles heel of the current economic environment. This idea of credit stress bubbling just underneath the surface, particularly in the banking sector.
Yeah, this is important. The third quarter bank earnings, on the surface, they looked deceptive. They seemed robust.
Right. Wall Street booming, consumers resilient.
Exactly. Most major banks reported lower net charge-offs, improving delinquencies. The consumer and small business segments were described as quite strong, actually.
Yet, despite those clean numbers, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, injected this deep sense of unease with what's become known as the cockroach warning.
Yes. Dimon raised serious concerns following the high-profile, sudden bankruptcies of these auto-related companies, Tricolor Holdings and First Brands.
Tricolor hit J.P. Morgan directly, didn't it?
It did. Resulted in a significant $170 million charge-off for J.P. Morgan. And Dimon's famous quote was a classic. When you see one cockroach, there are probably more.
The fear being
what?
Hidden risks.
The profound fear is that systemic financial risks are accumulating out of sight, especially within the highly opaque private credit markets that just lack the transparency of traditional banking.
And his warning proved prophetic almost immediately after those earnings calls, didn't it?
It did, yeah. The sources detail that later in the week, regional banks, Zions Bancorp and Western Alliance Bancorp, saw their stocks dip pretty sharply after they disclosed challenges related to, well, isolated fraud cases and specific borrower issues.
So not systemic collapse, but problems cropping up.
Exactly. It emphasizes that while the biggest, most diversified banks look strong on the surface, these isolated, chunky fraud losses are indeed accumulating across the mid-sized banking sector. And that spooks investors about wider contagion.
Okay, so beyond these anecdotal bankruptcies and fraud cases, what is the single most important indicator that investors should monitor for evidence of widespread systemic credit stress? What should you be watching?
You need to watch the Bear Over Treasuries credit spread, BAA.
Pay Over Treasuries. Okay, explain that.
It's a technical indicator that measures the difference in yield between bar-rated corporate bonds, that's the lowest rung of investment-grade debt, often considered sort of junk adjacent,
yeah,
and putatively risk-free government debt, U.S. Treasuries.
And why does the spread matter so much? What does it tell us?
Well, if financial stress is truly building in the system, investors quickly start selling off corporate debt, particularly that lower-rated bond debt. That forces its price down and its yield up relative to safe treasuries.
Widening the spread.
Exactly. If that credit spread widens rapidly, it signals that the market perceives a significant rise in default risk for thousands of corporations simultaneously. It's a broad market signal of fear.
Okay, where is that indicator standing right now, and what's the critical threshold that signals real trouble?
Currently, the bond over treasuries spread is at 1.72%. The critical level, the sort of wake-up call signaling deeper structural economic and credit concerns, is generally considered to be 2.00%. If it moves steadily higher towards and past 2%, it would suggest that the Tricolor and First Brands incidents are not isolated incidents, but maybe symptoms of a broader problem.
And this stress is compounded by a structural shift in how large banks lend, specifically regarding these opaque non-financial depository institution loans, or NFDIs. Can you define what NFDIs are and why they pose a risk?
Sure. NFDI stands for non-financial depository institution loans. Essentially, these are loans made by banks to other specialized non-bank financial intermediaries. Think hedge funds, private equity firms, dedicated credit funds, rather than lending directly to consumers or corporations.
Okay, so banks lending to other financial players. What's the problem?
The problem is opacity. These loans are often much less transparent and carry less stringent regulatory oversight than traditional bank lending. And they've grown dramatically now, accounting for about a third of large bank commercial loans.
A third? Wow.
Yeah. So if that bad spread hits 2%, it suggests the risks embedded in these opaque NFDIs might be becoming a systemic structural problem. There's just less visibility into the underlying risk.
Okay, this high level of credit ambiguity is coinciding with a significant political issue that's hampering monetary policy. The government shutdown. The Fed is essentially flying blind into its next rate decision.
Exactly. The shutdown is preventing the essential release of key economic data. No jobs report, no crucial retail sales figures, no PCE inflation gauge.
The Fed's preferred measure.
Right. Without this crucial real-time information, the Fed's upcoming October meeting is extraordinarily difficult. They're basically operating with outdated snapshots of the economy.
So absent that data, what is the consensus expectation for the upcoming rate decision? Will they just freeze entirely, hold steady?
Well, history suggests they will likely take the path of least resistance. In previous government shutdowns, the Fed almost always avoided aggressive moves, so the consensus expects the central bank to take the cautious route, a safe quarter percentage point cut, 25 basis points.
Just a small cut.
Yeah. This approach keeps the current easing cycle technically intact, signaling some support for the economy without committing to a major policy shift until they get clarity from the data again.
This uncertainty leads directly into a really profound debate about the fundamentals of the Fed's job itself, specifically the neutral interest rate, or R-star. What exactly is R-star, and why are financial forces supposedly making it elusive and irrelevant now?
Okay, so R-star is the theoretical neutral interest rate, the rate at which monetary policy is neither stimulating nor restricting economic growth. It's the sweet spot.
Right.
Bree Karana argues in the magazine that R-star is now elusive and irrelevant because traditional financial conditions are being distorted by massive non-rate sensitive forces,
right.
Forces outside the Fed's direct control.
What kind of forces are we talking about?
Well, think about AI investment, for example. Tech companies are investing billions based on long-term technological necessity, not really whether the Fed funds rate is 2% or 5%.
Right. It's strategic, not cyclical.
Exactly. Similarly, global trade tariffs, shifts in immigration policy, massive government spending, these are all driving demand or affecting supply, regardless of Fed rate policy. These non-monetary forces are distorting the traditional supply and demand dynamics, making the old guideposts for R-star completely unreliable, according to this view.
So if the traditional playbook is broken, what policy path should the Fed follow to minimize disruption? What's the alternative?
Karana advocates for a do-no-harm approach. This means reducing policy rates very gradually, quarter point by quarter point, just enough to support hiring, particularly for small businesses that are more rate-sensitive without reigniting inflation.
So gentle easing.
Gentle easing. He specifically warns that aggressive cuts could inflate asset prices even further, creating a dangerous wealth effect that fuels sticky services inflation.
And this is in direct contrast to the newest Fed governor.
Yes, Steven Marin. He apparently voted for a more aggressive 50 basis point cut at the previous meeting, arguing that current rates are actually very restrictive and need to come down faster. So you see the internal debate.
Yeah, definitely challenging cross currents for the Fed right now. Okay, let's pivot and look at some specific opportunities in high-risk areas globally, starting with the deeply counterintuitive world of short activism.
Right, we're profiling Carson Block of Muddy Waters Capital, one of the pioneers of short activism. The strategy where you bet against a company and then publish research alleging fraud or poor business practices to drive the price down.
And he says it's tough going right now.
Block confirms that in this high momentum, ebullient market, short activism is a very hard business right now. Mm. Really difficult.
Why is it so difficult for even a proven strategist like Block? What's changed?
There seem to be two main structural hurdles. First, stocks with strong momentum just run over the shorts, regardless of the quality of the critical research. Enthusiasm for growth simply outweighs fear.
Momentum trumps fundamentals, short term.
Often, yeah. Second, less risk-averse retail traders and passive index funds now hold a massive portion of the market. Index funds never sell based on a research report. They just hold the index. And retail traders are often driven more by emotional conviction or online communities than by traditional analysis. That makes it nearly impossible for a short report alone to induce the necessary selling pressure to make the trade work quickly.
So Block has had to fundamentally change his tactics. He can't operate the same way.
Absolutely. He now apparently avoids companies held heavily by index funds or those with huge retail followings. He focuses much more intensely on technical factors, waiting for the precise right timing and signs of volume breakdown before publishing. The focus is less on an instantaneous shock and more on capitalizing on long-term technical decay.
So what is he watching for now, given the intensity of the AI frenzy we've been discussing?
He's strategically developing inventory of speculative AI names. That's the phrase used.
Developing inventory? Sounds ominous.
Block believes many of these highly leveraged or perhaps conceptually unsound AI bets just won't work out in the long run. He is essentially waiting for the inevitable bubble, the point where the supply of speculative, maybe junk AI names exceeds the real investor demand.
And when that happens?
He expects that when that happens, people in his industry, the short sellers, will be pretty prolific in exposing the real grifts and scams out there, waiting for the tide to go out.
Fascinating. Sticking with activism, we also saw activist opposition to two significant M&A deals detailed in the sources, highlighting disputes over valuation.
That's right. Activist filings showed strong opposition to two major transactions. First, T. Rowe Price, which is usually a pretty passive institutional investor, shifted its stance to activist.
Oh, that's notable.
Yeah. They issued an open letter opposing the Dayforce private acquisition. Shareholders were offered $70 per share in cash, but T. Rowe argues the stock was fundamentally undervalued due to temporary short-term pessimism in the sector. They think the intrinsic value was far higher.
So they think the private equity buyer got too good a deal?
Essentially, yes. And the second opposition was focused on a company bridging crypto and AI.
Core Scientific Holdings.
Correct. 2C's Capital raised its stake in Core Scientific, which is a major Bitcoin mining and AI data center company. 2C's publicly expressed its intent to vote against Core Scientific's all-stock merger with CoreWeave.
And the issue there?
It valued shareholders at $20.40 per share. 2C's clearly indicated a belief that either the deal structure or the valuation attached to the AI potential of Core Scientific was just unsatisfactory for existing equity holders. Not enough value.
Okay, that brings us to an incredible, specific example of market timing and insider behavior related to the commodity space.
Trilogy Metals.
Right, Trilogy Metals, a Canadian miner working on the Ambler Road mining project up in Alaska, holds vast quantities of copper, other strategic metals. The stock went completely ballistic, soaring 211% on October 7th.
Just one day. What was the immediate catalyst for that explosion?
The catalyst was geopolitical and strategic. The U.S. government, specifically the Defense Department, announced it was taking a significant $365 million stake in the company.
It supports the Ambler Road project, signaling its necessity for securing domestic supply chains for critical minerals. Big government endorsement.
Okay, huge news, huge stock pop. And what happened in the hours and days immediately following that massive price spike?
Insiders cashed out very quickly. The company's CFO, Elaine Sanders, and five directors sold a combined millions in shares and exercised options immediately after the spike, literally on October 8th and 9th.
Wow.
The transaction detail for the CFO is particularly telling. She exercised an option to buy 450,000 shares at $1.81 and sold them hours later for around $6.80 to $6.90 apiece.
That's quite a return.
It strongly suggests that insiders believe the market peaked immediately upon the government's announcement, and they rushed, understandably perhaps, to realize those massive sudden gains. Sell the news.
That is a fascinating illustration of how political catalysts can create immediate liquidity events for insiders. Okay, let's switch gears. Head over to Europe for a minute. The French stock market seems to be completely ignoring the political turmoil surrounding Macron's government. How is that possible?
It is a remarkable paradox, isn't it? The French CAC 40 index is up a healthy 9% year to date, despite what the magazine calls the hot mess of political instability within Macron's coalition government.
So why the disconnect?
This decoupling seems to exist because French stocks are, perhaps surprisingly, an underappreciated export powerhouse.
Really? Can we quantify that export exposure?
Absolutely. 75% of sales for listed French companies happen beyond their borders. If you look at the top 10 names in the index companies like LVMH, L'Oreal, Sanofi, only the major bank BNP Paribas could truly be considered domestically facing.
So their revenue streams are global?
Largely global, yeah. Insulating them significantly from Parisian political chaos.
And structurally, France seems better positioned for stability than regional rivals like Germany, especially on energy.
Significantly better, particularly on the energy front. France draws approximately 70% of its electricity from reliable nuclear power.
Right, the nuclear fleet.
Which has insulated it from the acute energy cost crises that severely impacted Germany following the Russian gas cutoff. Plus, France has a strong, expanding defense sector. Major global players like Airbus and Safran benefiting directly from expanding European defense budgets.
Okay, so given this structural strength, are there any specific value plays analysts are pointing to in the French market right now?
Yes. Analysts point to potential value in the major bank BNP Paribas, which is still lagging behind some of its European peers on valuation. And the oil supermajor Total Energies also looks compelling.
Why Total Energies?
It trades at a forward price-to-earnings ratio of about 10. That's significantly cheaper than its U.S. rivals like ExxonMobil and Chevron, which trade closer to 15 times P.E. This discount is attributed specifically to the fact that the company happens to be listed in France, not the U.S., the Europe discount.
Interesting. Speaking of global risks and safety plays, we have to talk about the gold rally again. The metal is up 57% this year. Just relentless.
Gold is hitting new record highs constantly. The sources mentioned 21 times in the last 63 trading sessions alone.
Wow.
And the drivers are structural, with profound geopolitical implications. Central banks have been massive net buyers, particularly post-sanctions.
Diversifying away from the dollar.
Exactly. Nations looking to diversify reserves away from dollar reliance after seeing how quickly dollar-denominated assets can be frozen. This seems fundamentally different from just a simple speculative rally driven by individuals.
And Jamie Dimon's comments on gold certainly got everyone's attention, didn't they? Calling it semi-rational to own.
Yeah, he suggested gold could easily go to $5,000, $10,000 in environments like this. He added that, given the geopolitical and fiscal uncertainty, it's one of the few times in my life it's semi-rational to have some in your portfolio. High praise, or maybe high concern, from him.
Given this extraordinary run, what, if anything, could stop the rally, according to analysts? Is there anything on the horizon?
Not much is expected to stop it in the near term, honestly. The only thing that historically kills a gold bull market is a determined Federal Reserve tightening cycle.
And the Fed is cutting rates, not raising them.
Exactly. So that headwind isn't there. Furthermore, history suggests this kind of momentum has serious staying power. When gold sets this many new highs over a three-month period, analysts find the price is typically higher 80% of the time 1 year later. Momentum begets momentum often.
Okay, before we delve back into technology and investment tactics, there's a fascinating geopolitical sign of stress affecting the wealthy. This Plan B visa trade.
Ah, yes, New Zealand. They're actively targeting affluent foreigners with its revised Active Investor Plus visa, specifically easing requirements for permanent residency.
Which runs counter to the trend in many countries tightening immigration.
Exactly. And the motivation for these applicants, according to the reporting, pure fear and uncertainty driven by global politics. One advisory firm noted that Americans now account for 75% of their business.
75%.
Driven almost entirely by U.S. domestic political uncertainty and polarization.
So these affluent individuals are essentially buying insurance against political risk by getting residency elsewhere.
Exactly. They are seeking a Plan B, prioritizing democracy, safety, and maybe remoteness from potential global conflicts. That shift in priority from pure financial returns to existential security is a profound signal of elevated global uncertainty, at least among those with the means to move.
That leads us nicely back to the AI landscape, but looking at it through the intellectual framework provided by the latest Nobel Prize in economics, this helps provide context for the upheaval we're currently witnessing.
Right, the 2025 Nobel Prize went to Joel Mokyr, Philip Baghian, and Peter Howitt for their work on technological innovation. Specifically, their deep exploration of the theory of creative destruction.
Okay, for those unfamiliar with the term, can you clearly define what creative destruction means in this context and why it is so relevant to AI right now?
Sure. Creative destruction basically describes how radical new technologies inevitably unsettle incumbents and establish market structures. Innovation undermines the advantages of existing companies, allowing new entrants to steal business and eventually supplant the old guard.
Like mainframes to PCs or the web disrupting older media?
Exactly. Think of the way mainframe computers were disrupted by PCs and then the World Wide Web was disrupted by smartphones and mobile commerce. AI is just the latest and potentially fastest inflection point for this process. And private investors are betting heavily on it, pouring an astonishing $259 billion into AI startups since 2024, betting precisely on this concept of violent disruption.
The Nobel laureate's work also provides a policy framework, suggesting innovation requires a careful balance of ingredients, right? It doesn't just happen.
It does. Their work suggests the innovation flywheel relies on a fragile balance. Things like smart patent protection to incentivize invention, strong support for higher education, readily available innovative financing, open trade policies, and importantly, lenient bankruptcy laws.
Why lenient bankruptcy laws?
Because they efficiently reallocate capital and labor from failing companies to burgeoning, more successful ones. It clears out the deadwood quickly. The key takeaway for you, the investor, is that this theory suggests continued intense upheaval in the tech business. Creative destruction isn't just theory. It's why someone like Carson Block is waiting patiently to short speculative AI names. New giants emerge, but the old guard and the cheap knockoffs often fade away, sometimes violently.
That drive for creative destruction leads us right to how AI is moving from the data center into mainstream consumer commerce. Walmart is pioneering what's called agentic commerce.
Yes, this represents potentially a major evolution in retail technology. Walmart is partnering with OpenAI to allow customers to purchase its products directly through ChatGPT using instant checkout.
How is this different from just getting recommendations?
It moves beyond simple recommendations based on past purchases. Agentic AI is designed to autonomously set and achieve goals. For example, suggesting a week's worth of groceries based on a loose prompt like plan healthy meals for my family, cross-referencing dietary restrictions you've shared, and then ordering them all seamlessly, all without direct, step-by-step human prompting for each item. The AI acts as your agent.
And analysts seem to believe Walmart is making a genuinely smart move here, getting ahead of this.
They seem overwhelmingly positive. Mizzou called it a major step forward in the adoption and broader acceleration of agentic commerce. Analysts believe Walmart is ahead of the curve because they embraced integrating AI directly into their commerce platform early on.
While others were trying to block AI.
While many other retailers apparently wasted time trying to block AI web crawlers from scraping their inventory data. By being the early leader in this high-volume vertical, Walmart could drive significant structural volume directly into its core consumables and grocery business.
Okay, fascinating potential there. Finally, let's wrap up with a tactical investing strategy that directly leverages the market volatility we discussed earlier, using options to potentially buy stocks on the cheap.
Right. The mantra here, according to the source, is that when the VIX spikes, disciplined investors should see it as an opportunity to profit from the fear of others.
The VIX, the SIBO Volatility Index, reflecting implied volatility.
Exactly. When it spikes during market declines, the premiums on options rise dramatically. And this is the core benefit of the strategy discussed, selling put options.
Okay, explain how that works for someone who wants to maybe leg into a stock position at a discount. How does selling a put achieve that?
Okay, so by selling a put option, you are receiving a cash premium immediately, right now.
Cash in your account.
Cash in your account. In return, you take on the obligation to buy the stock at a lower designated strike price if the stock falls to or below that level by the option's expiration date. The crucial detail is the implied volatility. When the VIX is high, that premium you receive for selling the put is larger.
So you get paid more for taking on the risk.
Precisely. You are essentially setting a buy price you like for the stock and getting paid upfront for the chance to potentially buy it there.
And legging in means you don't commit all your capital at once.
Correct. The idea is a sophisticated investor might divide their investable amount and sell puts at different, successively lower strike prices over time. That's the process of legging in, building a position gradually, and mitigating the risk of going all in at the wrong price.
The Oracle example in the source makes this pretty clear for the listener, I think.
Right. Imagine Oracle stock is trading at, say, $299, but you believe it's only a really great buy below $280. You could sell the November $208 put option. If Oracle stays above $280 through November expiration, you simply keep the entire premium you collected up front. The option expires worthless. You profited without buying the stock.
Nice. And if it falls?
If the stock falls to, say, $270, you are obligated to buy the stock at your strike price of $280. But because you receive that premium up front, your effective purchase price is actually lower than $280 and lower than the market price, where others might have panicked and sold. It's a structured way to potentially act greedy when others are fearful.
What an extensive deep dive today. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground, really, from the massive expensive power demands of the AI trade to these tactical options moves you can use in your portfolio today.
Yeah, the overarching theme of this week's sources, it seems to me, is the profound tension in the market right now. You've got the extremely expensive soaring AI trade represented by companies like Constellation and Quanta.
High valuations, high expectations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Versus the necessary, stable, anti-AI assets like Colgate that provide portfolio defense and stability. And that entire structure is underscored by those bubbling credit risks we discussed, symbolized by Jamie Dimon's cockroaches and that slowly rising Bay Over Treasuries credit spread.
So it's like a structure built on intense enthusiasm, but maybe under attack from fundamental credit concerns underneath.
That seems to be the core tension, yeah.
And this confluence of factors paints a highly complex and, frankly, contradictory picture for the future. The concentration risk in the S&P 500 is undeniable, as is the structural demand for the energy powering the AI boom. But so, too, is the political uncertainty driving things like the Plan B visa trade.
Which raises a critical question for you, the investor, to really consider as we close today. If we look at the historical indicators, record gold prices suggesting profound debasement fears, record stock valuations with the Shiller-KP ratio approaching 40.
40, a level previously seen only at the 1929 and 2000 market peaks. Really extreme territory.
Are those historical benchmarks for determining a bubble still relevant today?
Given structural shifts driven by these non-monetary forces, we talked about AI, geopolitical instability, central bank buying of gold, perhaps the traditional metrics for valuation just no longer apply with the same force they once did. Is it different this time?
Or is it never different? Mm-hmm. Do we need to rely much more heavily on market timing, utilizing strategies like selling puts and equal weighting just to navigate the next decade of likely intense volatility? Or can we still believe in the long-term buy and hold thesis even when valuations look this stretched on historical measures? That, I think, is the ultimate test of your investment conviction in this new structurally uncertain era.
Fascinating stuff to ponder. Thank you for diving deep with us today. We'll talk to you next time.